tired of being told what they can watch, babies will start their own television network. It will feature such popular shows as Dripping Faucet, Small Spinning Box with Ribbon, and Dawson's Creek.
From two corners of the world, it's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else? Films. I'm your co-host, Nick, and joining me, as always, is Alex. Alex, how are you doing? I know that things have been a little hairy this last week for Minnesota, well, in the States in general.
Yeah, I mean, at the day, as we're recording, today is August 29th, and yeah, it has been a harrowing roller coaster of a week, to put it mildly. But, you know, I'm hanging in there, you know? Just trying to do the best I can, as always. What about you?
Well, as long as you're okay, that's the important thing. Yeah, I mean, I can't complain too much. I'm doing just fine, honestly. It's been a pretty quiet week in England. Now it's, even though it's still August, it feels like we're in the late stages of September, so it feels like autumn, which is slightly annoying, but what are you going to do? It's the United Kingdom. So I've just got my little raincoat, my little cup of tea ready to go in these sorts of weather conditions, and I am excited to be talking about yet another film in our ongoing miniseries of films from the year 2000. And, you know, I gotta say, Alex, it has been, like you said, it's been a tough week. It's been a pretty difficult week. You know, we had a couple of twin hurricanes. We've, in the States, I mean, in the UK, we're doing relatively fine-ish, but, you know, things aren't great. It's all just kind of a tenuous situation, I guess. And you know, I think it would just make sense, you know, when we were looking at this podcast to think about, well, maybe this episode we'll be talking about something that's a little more optimistic, a little more upbeat. And I have to say, Alex, I don't think this week's movie fit the bill. I think maybe just a little bit. No, it's the movie that we decided to watch for this week was Amoros Perros, which many of you might know as Alejandro González Iñárritu's directorial debut. And of course, as many of you might be familiar with his work, including, of course, Birdman and The Revenant, Iñárritu has really proven himself to be one of the most interesting and certainly technically innovative filmmakers within the mainstream within the last decade, I would say. And we thought, you know, it would make sense to go back to his feature debut, which, honestly, I mean, I had seen some of Iñárritu's other films, but this was one I hadn't seen before. Alex, had you seen this film before, too? Or how familiar were you with Iñárritu's work before coming to Amoros Perros?
Well, you know, it's interesting, because the first film of his I had seen was actually Babel 14 years ago. And so I had been aware of him as an auteur, but aside from that and Birdman and The Revenant, I hadn't seen his other works yet. I certainly hadn't seen Amores Perros before, but it was one of those films I had always been meaning to actually get around to seeing. So I was kind of looking forward to this episode because we have a family member who, actually, when I told her that we were going to do this, she was excited because she told me that this is one of her all-time favorite movies. And I know that she loves his Spanish language features, this one, and also Beautiful with Javier Bardem. So I was very curious to see this movie. And even though Iñárritu, he's a very peculiar, interesting director for me, because he's one of those guys who, yes, as you said, he is technically, he's a masterful director. I think he's really proven himself on a technical level. And I would also argue with the actors too, the way he directs actors and the performances he gets from them. But his movies had been more often than not works that I hadn't been as crazy about as, say, other people. Like, I remember being honestly infuriated that he won, that Birdman won Best Picture at the Oscars, beating Boyhood.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really in complete agreement with you. in every respect. I mean, it was something too where I have to confess that I am not the biggest fan of Iñárritu's work that I have seen. Yeah, the only ones I haven't seen are 21 Grams and Beautiful, but all the other films that I've seen of his, I mean, even Babel, I remember. I mean, it's been, but like you said, it's been a while since watching that film. But I just remember thinking to myself that it has a, it had a lot of formally interesting components, but I felt, I don't know, a little cold from it. But I definitely preferred it to the stylistically virtuosic, if not self-indulgent, aspects of stuff like Birdman or The Revenant, which, I mean, I think The Revenant is definitely, it takes a lot from Tarkovsky and Malick, but doesn't quite live up to the stature of some of those filmmakers' best works. I mean, I have some problems in terms of the way that his scripts sort of, they succumb to certain stereotypes or tropes that are regressive at best and really obnoxious at worst. And in the case of Birdman, I agree with you. Like, there are some moments of that movie that are incredibly annoying. And in terms of just the way that he decides to reduce some potential rooms for complexity for the sake of a cheap laugh. But
honestly, Birdman is like what people expected BoJack Horseman to be when watching the first season.
Oh my God, no! Oh God, yeah. I mean, yeah. Birdman's the more technically sophisticated version of BoJack Horseman, but BoJack Horseman is just like Birdman with a deeply more nuanced and layered portrayal of show business that lacks the Godardian mimicry and pastiche. But we're talking today about a film that is resoundingly not a comedy. And the thing is, it is interesting to think about Iñárritu. Like, for his first four features, he was not known as what you may consider a funny director. He didn't make funny movies. And Amoros Perros is certainly not a funny movie. I can't think of a single moment in this movie where even there's a trace of black comedy. Or maybe it's a little more subdued than I was imagining, but it is, on the whole, a pretty sobering and, in his words, visceral look at a trio of stories circulating around different denizens of Mexico City from differing social classes, and them navigating around the fallout, essentially, of a central event, which is a car crash, which isn't too much of a spoiler because that's what the film opens on a car crash. And we sort of jump back and forth more or less in time to follow these different stories. And the car crash, with each revisitation of the car crash, we get more and more of a sense of context of that event. And I just wanted to, on a gut level, I wanted to ask, how did you find this film, Alex? What did you think of it?
Well, you know, I actually I was kind of surprised that I was surprised at how much I got into it, you know, how emotionally involved I was getting into the film. I mean, the term he used was visceral, and he, like, from the first frame, he like, hurls you into this environment and into this intensity. Like, it opens with a car chase, and you're just hooked from then on. And I think you're compelled to see what happens, and you're also intrigued and compelled to see how the stories are connected, what happens with each of these people before and after the car accident, and how it affects these lives. And I did find it interesting, though there were some characters or components that I found more interesting than others. Like, for a while, honestly, my favorite character in the movie was this, there's this hobo character who turns out to be Hitman. He's kind of like Ghost Dog or so. And he doesn't have a lot of dialogue in the film. He just emotes and expresses with his face. So, and I found this character to be very intriguing to follow, but like on a story-based level, I was compelled to follow these people, even as twisted and as dark as they got, but I wanted to see what would happen next with them. As terms of like on a thematic or like a spiritual level, I think it does some things that are really interesting and really good. And then there are a couple of moments or so which I'm kind of, I feel like you can kind of, it's an Inarritu film through and through, both the good and the bad.
So when you say the good and the bad, what are the markers that that you would associate with him that are good and which are the less good that you can see being evident in his directorial debut?
Well, I think one of the things that I like about him as a director is, as I was alluding to, are I do think he is very skilled at directing his actors, and he can get some strong performances out of them. And there are some great acting in this movie, like Gael Garcia Bernal is in it too, as this young guy.
And this was his first movie as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah, this is before he would later go on to do, yeah, films like Ita Mama Tami. And I think Bernal has proven to be an excellent actor in his own right. But, like, you have him as this guy who then takes his, like, brother's dog and engages the dog in dog fights. And so he can raise money, and so he can run away with his sister-in-law, who he's in love with. And he doesn't like the way his brother treats her so indecently.
No, because his brother is, yeah, I mean, essentially they're all living together in kind of a cramped, lower middle class household. It's the two brothers, their mother, and the older brother, Ramiro, his wife, whose name is Susanna. Gael Garcia Bernal's character is named Octavio. They're all living together in this little cramped house, and yeah, Ramiro is a very abusive, very bullying figure. I mean, all he does is just, I mean, the very first time we see him in the movie, he's giving Susanna a hard time about bleaching his shirt for work, because he works as a checkout boy at a pharmacy. And he clearly is a character who doesn't have... Well, none of these characters have much hope in terms of their social standing in life. Now, Octavio still has a sense of hope in terms of what his future could be, which is why he inadvertently becomes involved in dogfighting when their dog, this Rottweiler, this big old Rottweiler named Coffee, he gets loose, and this real psychopathic criminal... And who is kind of a champion with dogfighting, he ends up sicking his prize-winning dog, his big champion dog, on Coffee just for kicks, because he's a sadist. His dog ends up getting mauled by Coffee. And so Gael Garcia Bernal thinks, well, maybe this dog can actually make me some money. So he enters this dog as a dog within dogfights. And, I got to tell you, Alex, from my personal vantage point, I remember when this movie came out. I mean, I'm glad neither of us saw this movie when it came out. We were way too young for it. But it was one of those movies that it always was synonymous in my mind with the stature of Amoros Perros. Like, aside from it being Iñárritu's directorial debut, like the other thing that would just leap to my mind is, oh, that's the Mexican dogfighting movie. And so immediately, if I'd be looking through my Netflix queue and I'd look for a movie to watch, I'd be like, oh, I need to catch up on something. And I'm like, oh, what about Amoros Perros? And then there'd always be that little reminder, and I just think, oh, maybe not today. Maybe next time. So from my vantage point, I was really glad to get the opportunity to finally come to this film for this episode as well. I have to say that I was pleasantly surprised by it too, in the sense that I was... Because, I mean, when this film came out, it really caused quite a splash. And it stood a very good chance of winning the Best Foreign Language Feature Oscar. And it would have been the first Mexican film to do so. That ended up happening with Roma. Amoros Perros didn't win. It went to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which eclipsed What's everything that? Else. Yeah, I know. Some obscure art house martial arts movie. I mean, forget about it. We'll never talk about it again, I promise. But all that to say that Amoros Perros was definitely it was an art house hit, and it did leave a mark when it premiered at Cannes in 2000. It won, I think, the Critics' Jury Prize.
Yeah,
if I'm not
it won
mistaken.
The Critics' Week Prize. Yeah,
Critics' Week Prize, and it really opened the door for Iñárritu to follow up with his other films like 21 Grams and Babel, which formed what what has been kind of termed his death trilogy, which I remember when you were telling me about this, when we were preparing for this episode, you mentioned that this phrase has been thrown around. And I got to be honest, Alex, I'm a little confused by that term, because I would argue that death is a constant in nearly all of his movies, not just this trilogy. But why do you think it is that, I mean, neither of us have seen 21 Grams, but with Amores Perros and Babel, what do you think it is about these films that have been grouped together?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because you're right, absolutely right. I feel like death is prevalent in all of his features, even Birdman. What makes, and I was looking this up a little bit too, but what makes his death trilogy stand out from his other works are quite a few factors. One of them being how they, and this is kind of interesting, how we've been discussing about this with some other movies too that we've been doing these past few weeks, but how they have like a network narrative to them. They focus on stories that are interconnected with each other, even if the details or the connections aren't made clear to the characters, but they're clear to us, the audience. And they're usually like connected through a violent incident, like in Amores Perros and 21 Grams, it's a car accident. And in Babel, it's an accidental shooting. And also the fact that, but what's interesting is that there's a transition from like Amores Perros takes place essentially in Mexico City, then how Iñárritu transitioned his kind of that network connection from and made it grander into more vast from that to like say in the southwestern U.S. state of 21 Grams, to then Babel with like covering different countries around the globe like Mexico and Japan and I believe Morocco also, and all three of these movies he had co-written with Guillermo Arriaga.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, Guillermo Arriaga. And I mean, what's interesting, I mean, I think you've pinpointed some really great, some very clear signifiers for what distinguishes these three films from his ensuing work. And I think it's interesting that you're talking about this question of, again, returning to network narratives and something also which was sort of coined by Alyssa Quart called hyperlink cinema. Which is, I think, for all extents and purposes, is essentially similar to what David Bordwell was talking about when he was defining network narratives, where it is this series of interconnected stories that might be multilinear, or they coincide, but maybe in one respect, and as you said, they're not apparent to all of the characters. But I think it's really interesting that a movie like Amores Perros. The way that I think another way that Iñárritu described it that I thought was really striking, he said in a behind the scenes interview, he described it as something akin to an amalgamated play, which I think actually is pretty appropriate, especially when we get to the second and third stories. I mean, all of the stories actually are. More, I mean, they span different locations, but a lot of them are confined to domestic spheres. Those are just different, though, you know, because again, we have in the first story kind of lower middle class domesticity. In the second story, you have an affluent couple's apartment, newly purchased apartment. And then in the third story, you begin to follow the vagrant that you were talking about earlier, El Chivo, and his situation as a homeless man.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's, I like how you pointed out of it being sort of, you know, just compared to theater and play, which is interesting too, because that, I think, certainly is a trait that you see in his other work. I mean, that's most apparent in Birdman, since it literally takes place behind the scenes of developing a play.
Absolutely. And in primarily one location, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, and then sometimes you get different locations, too, but they all feel like It's like, but it feels confined, almost like you could see this like a stage play. But what I find interesting too, that you also pointed out, is how a lot of it, there's a lot of interior scenes in which the major action takes place with these, with each one of these stories. And what I found interesting too, it wasn't until I watched this video actually that was talking about it, and what stuck out to me, I didn't think of until this guy pointed it out, and I thought it was very intriguing, was how Iñárritu and his DP Rodrigo Prieto, how they shoot to these stories. And what I thought was kind of a little bold of them was to not try to visually distinguish the stories, like say Soderbergh did with Traffic, but how he shoots them more or less in the same style. They shoot with these wide angle lenses. And I actually think that was kind of, I think it's kind of bold on his part, because I think he's trying to, even though the characters are in different class statuses, I think his intention is trying to put them all on a status of emotional equilibrium. You know, when you take all these, when you take class conventions, you know, toss them aside, how, you know, we're all human beings, you know, and we all can share these similar emotions. And I think that's actually quite powerful.
Right. No, I think that's a really great observation that you made in comparison to Traffic. That yes, it is a much more unified aesthetic, in the sense that Iñárritu and Prieto, who of course Prieto went on to shoot several films for Scorsese within the last decade.
He did like Iñárritu's first four films too, and he's also worked with Ang Lee. He's become an excellent DP in his own right.
Oh, he's a tremendous DP, and he does great work here too. In terms of, I mean, the aesthetic of the film is, it is almost indicative of kind of that era of like late 90s, early 2000s, gritty cinema verite, high contrast photography. It's almost, and there are some moments even where there are moments where the photography looks bleached out, almost like the whites are blown out, and it has this grimy feeling and texture to the whole thing. But again, like you said, I mean, it does give this sense of unity and a shared sense of despair that doesn't discriminate based upon class. It infects everybody. I mean, there's this in the second story, essentially, there's a there's another couple, Valeria and Danielle, and essentially Valeria is involved in the car crash. She is injured and she has to rest and recuperate at home in this new apartment that her partner has helped procure. And this partner, it's also worth noticing, has left his family to be with this woman. And Valeria is a supermodel, so her career is very contingent upon her appearance and her health and well-being. So, of course, she spirals into something of a depression. And when that happens, there's this interesting manifestation of that anger and despair and desperation, really, that begins to manifest with the apartment itself, in terms of essentially one thing leading to another, and the floors of this apartment getting ripped open. It's sort of, I don't know about you, but it kind of reminded me a little bit of the ending of spoiler alert for people who haven't seen The Conversation, but it's a little like the ending of The Conversation, where, you know, that character rips up his apartment to try and find something, and he can't find it. And so he's just left with kind of this husk of a domicile where he doesn't really feel safe or secure. Did you get that impression at all, or is that just me projecting?
I hadn't thought of that, but I love that you made that connection to The Conversation. I think you're exactly on point. But, and I think also to add to that, there's the thing, because in this case, it's because she has a dog, and the dog ends up getting caught, falls in a hole. You don't ask, but
it's all very convoluted.
Yeah, even though what's interesting and what I love is that actually Arriaga and Iñárritu, they base that on a real life incident. Apparently, somebody that happened to a dog, but they they said in real life though, they said ended where the floor. Then they said it starts smelling bad. So,
well, I mean, we won't spoil if that's what happens here too. But I mean, all of that is to say that there is this interesting, almost metaphorical significance afforded to the fact that there are rats under the floorboard, and Valeria's worried that the rats will have eaten their dog.
And also, what I like too is how there's the the sound effects, like throughout the night, you know, Valeria and Danielle, they keep hearing like the dog, like, you know, tittering, scratching against, you know, under the floorboards and going throughout different rooms of the apartment, and they can hear him like whining and howling. So they're trying to get him, but he just won't come out. So it's like that nagging persistence, and it, you know, becomes aggravating to the point where they kind of end up erupting against each other.
Well, I mean, it compounds the aggravation and the tension that's already simmering between them with her accident and his own. Again, the fact that he has just left his family and he's sort of grappling with that. And yeah, it's a very claustrophobic. I mean, the film has a lot of claustrophobic sequences in it, but I think that section, that second story, is the most claustrophobic of the three main stories.
You compared the conversation, I can see where you're coming from, but honestly, I was thinking a little bit of like a less surreal nightmare, but still kind of nightmare scenario, like a less surreal version of Roman Polanski's Repulsion.
Yeah.
And one of the recurring visuals, too, in that story that I thought was very effective and that I really liked was because one of the reasons they also choose this location is because outside the apartment window, there's this billboard that with her face on it, you know, part of this campaign that she was doing.
Enchant, it's a perfume.
Yes, Enchant. But... And so it's like then when she can wake up and then she can see her face outside the window. But I like how that takes on different meanings as the story progresses. Like, you know, then after the accident and she's stuck in this wheelchair, it's almost like it's taunting and tormenting her, you know, just as she's looking out and seeing this thing looking right back at her of like of something that she is unable to do, like unable to... in her modeling career.
Well, it's not really her face as much as it's her body, isn't it? You know, because it's a full profile still photograph.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's that sense of not just mobility, but in terms of just complete freedom with the human body and how that's restricted by this accident. And of course, how that leads to some tragic consequences later on down the road. I mean, that's it's interesting because I think that is, I think there's something interesting with the way that Iñárritu emphasizes not bodily harm. I don't want to say what, but there is bodily harm in this film. Of course, it's a movie about dog fighting, for God's sakes, you know. And I mean, I will say this: the one thing that I was very worried about was, and it was something that drew controversy when the film was first released, was that the dog fighting sequences would be exploitative. But I don't know about you, but I didn't feel like they were. I feel like they were actually as tastefully done as they could have been in terms of the way that it's edited, and Iñárritu really relies upon the use of sound to just fill in the gaps of your imagination. He just leaves you with the bloody aftermath more often than not. And it's still, of course, it's not easy to watch, but I mean, in any case, my whole point being that this film is very much about the fallibility and the fragility of the human body. And I mean, and that succumbs to either death, as you said, injury, or old age, as is the case with El Chivo, the vagrant in the third story.
Well, I was just going to say, like, no, I agree with you. And honestly, with the dog fights, I didn't feel they were exploitative. I actually think he did do a tasteful job. And you're right. It's interesting because I still think when you watch them, they're not for the squeamish, but it is kind of, I knew about some of the details of how they were able to like shoot these scenes, but do them safely. And I think even some of the dogs were Iñárritu's own dogs. So if he was going to be concerned about any of these pooches, but like also hearing about the details of the way they shot those scenes of like when you see the dogs going at each other, they're not really fighting but playing. So it's kind of like, it's kind of amusing to me to go, oh, look at them playing. But they also had these like things they put in their mouths so they wouldn't like bite each other. And then when they're like, when they go limp from being dead, they actually had them sedated and for 20 minutes. But uh, I But they were doing it. Of course, they were doing it safely. You know, they had to. They had animal control behind them. You know, and to make sure that they were being very responsible with the animals. So I think and you're right. I think it's actually effective where you do get a little of like these quick flash cuts of the dogs going at each other, but then you cut to the reactions of the people, like either like cheering on, like going like "Go get him!" or so, and you hear the sounds of the dogs like snarling and whimpering. And that, you're right, that fills the gaps, and it's actually more intense than it, and more unnerving than if you saw it, if you saw it in explicit detail, like actual dog mauling. And I think that that's his point. He wants to make you uncomfortable. He wants to make you feel unnerved. And, you know, the comparison between, like, of bodily harm between dogs and humans, I think he's, again, there's that, that desire to put people on a state of equilibrium, because he's like saying, yeah, we're not so, you know, because of how humans tend to, I think of themselves as like a higher species. But he's like, no, you know, we're actually not so different from each other.
Well, and again, it ties into, I would argue, his later films as well. You can see it with Babel, when Cate Blanchett is shot and most of the movie she spends incapacitated, essentially. And the same thing almost with Leo DiCaprio in The Revenant. After he gets mauled by that bear, he essentially is crawling his way through that nearly the entirety of that movie. And Iñárritu is trying to, I think as a filmmaker, I think one of the things that he's been interested in throughout his career is the way that the fallibility of the human body betrays us. And how do people react when we are confronted with the fallibility of our own bodies? And some of the attendant sensations with those bodies, like desire. Like, desire is a huge theme in this film as well, particularly carnal and sexual desire, because Octavio, the Gael García Bernal character, is very much attracted to his sister-in-law, and he's constantly telling her, oh, I'm wanting to make a plan for us to run away to Juarez. You know, I'm saving up enough money, I mean, which he's getting from these dogfights, and he's telling her, you know, to come away with him, and he's really projecting so much of his desire on this woman who already has a child, who's his brother's child, presumably his brother's child. I know that the brother is angry that he had a kid, but you know, but that's the situation, and she's pregnant with his second child. So there's this kind of, I mean, what's interesting is that in the interactions between Octavio and Susanna, I don't know about you, but I mean, I personally never got the feeling while watching these characters that there was like a budding romance. It didn't feel like that there was, it's not a relationship that is born from affection as much as desperation. Was that your, I don't know if that was your feeling as well.
No, I agree with you. Like, and there's this obsession too with it, like controlling. He's always trying to call in charge. He's trying to be the one calling the shots and saying, yeah, we're gonna have this plan, I'm gonna take you away, you and your kid, and we're gonna live this life together. And she's very resistant to that. She's very hesitant to it, but he keeps on insisting. He's like, no, you know, I know what's good. And I think that also ties into, like, I was reading an essay too about the film, and I think it ties into recurring themes of like the machismo masculinity, the sense of like, oh, you gotta, you know, of like being able to be in charge and to dominate and control, whether it's through, you know, Octavio and Ramiro, or even the sadist gangster guy who, you know, might have some homosexual undertones to him. Even Iñárritu said that he intended to be ambiguous on whether or not the guy is, you know, could be a homosexual or not, because of the way he tries to belittle other people by saying, oh, you know, like the way he calls Octavio a sissy many times or so. And maybe, you know, it's like how it's, you know, it's like trying to deflect any potential kind of, you know, concerns of being considered gay himself. I mean, even you got this guy with tattoos and bleach blonde hair.
Well, I was just going to say, this gangster is also 80% of the movie that he's in, he's shirtless. He has no shirt whatsoever. So there is very much an emphasis on this brash display of machismo going on here that does have some homoerotic undertones. And if it's not explicitly a queer reading, it certainly is very much rooted in this question of male dominance. And it's a very male-dominated movie in a lot of respects, even though you know, the second story centers around Valeria in a lot of ways. But I think one of the interesting things is that one of the recurring themes in this film is the absence of fathers, or the focus on absent fathers as well. So Octavio and Ramiro, they live with their mother. We don't know what happened to their father. Valeria's father briefly is mentioned, but she wants, you know, after her accident, she tells Daniel to not call her father. And they're clearly estranged. And then El Chivo, in the third story, he himself is a father who has only started trying to see his estranged daughter from afar after her mother passes away. So I think there is something very interesting going on here about the sense of fatherhood and estranged fathers in this film. And what does that mean about the absence of a father? What kind of an impact does that have on these characters? And again, it's something that I would argue is a recurring theme in his other work,
yeah,
too.
I think about scenes like, for example, I think of the part in Birdman where even Keaton talks to Norton in the bar and he talks about how what inspired him to become an actor. And it was like meeting this actor in a bar. So I think it alludes to possibly like somebody he can look up to, like a father figure, and like how
whole relationship to Emma Stone in that movie too.
Yeah.
As his daughter.
You also forgot to mention in Perros too, like Daniel himself, he's a father of two kids. The fact that he leaves them, mm-hmm. you know, for this woman. Mm-hmm. So you're right. That, and also, yeah, with The Revenant too, Leo DiCaprio, and how he's on a quest to avenge his son because he failed to protect him.
Well, then I'm thinking of Babel. I remember one of the few things I remember from that movie is Rinko Kikuchi's character. Like, she has an estranged relationship with her father too. I don't know if you remember that at all, but I remember
I remember that. Yeah, and like how it's coupled with her sense of loneliness, and also like dealing with the trauma too, because you know, it's insinuated that her mother committed suicide.
Right. That's right. Yeah, I'd forgotten that her mother had committed suicide. So even that's like the father having to fill this absence and his incapacity to do so. You know, I mean, there is this sense of inadequacy or failure for men to be fathers, you know, which I think is an interesting... I don't think we can really psychoanalyze Inarritu here, but I do think it's an interesting theme that recurs in a lot of his work. I wanted to bring it back to the discussion back to something you said a little earlier, Alex. You were talking about, again, the aesthetic of the film and in terms of how it presents its characters on more or less something of an equal footing in terms of the way that their sense of despair, or this oppressive despair is permeating every corner of their society. And I don't think, you know, and I do agree with you in the sense that Iñárritu is more, he's not a political filmmaker in the sense that he's trying to talk specifically about one social malady that's affecting a particular society, or like a series of maladies that are affecting one particular society, because as we were talking about with Babel, I mean, that is a transnational film that's trying to portray kind of a broader portrait of communication and language. But I do think, I mean, I would have to guess that, I mean, it's something that I can't speak with an authoritative stance, but I'd have to imagine that sense of social malcontent and unease and the simmering tension within Mexico, I mean, that must have been something that struck a chord with a lot of people, because Mexico was really going through a pretty profound historical change at that moment. I mean, as some of you might know, that was 2000 was the year Vicente Fox was elected as the president. That was important because he was the first political candidate who was not part of the PRI, which was the Institutional Revolutionary Party, and that was formed in the late 1920s, outside, kind of in the aftermath of the Mexican Revolution. And that party had been in power for the majority of the 20th century in Mexico. And, of course, over the span of 70 years, more or less, the party had ultimately become synonymous with corruption and social malaise. I mean, in fact, what's interesting, there were some exit polls that were conducted for the election. And, I mean, this is something I looked up, and it was really interesting that more than half of the Mexican populace, according to these exit polls, as well as, or rather I should say, this particular poll I was looking at, about 43% of those surveyed in exit polls cited that one of the chief issues for them in their decision to vote was corruption. And more than half of the Mexican populace over the span of the 5 years before the election stated that they had little or no confidence in any of the major national institutions aside from the Catholic Church, which is interesting because we see actually quite a bit of Catholic iconography in Amoros Perros as well. And I think, you know, Iñárritu doesn't linger on it too much, but it's, you see several rooms where people have crucifixes. There's a moment where El Chivo showers himself near the end of the film. And I don't know about you, Alex, but to me that felt very much drenched, so to speak, within Catholic imagery of redemption, of the cleansing of sins, of a rebirth, you know, because then he shaves himself and he really looks like a new man.
Yeah, no, I was definitely thinking of that when watching that scene. You're right. And I mean, I'm glad you singled out and mentioned Mexico's history, and then that, you know, seemed, since that plays such a crucial role in not just this movie and to why it spoke to so many people, but because, yeah, of the history, yeah, of the decades of, like you said, not just corruption, but then you also have violence, which occurred like in the 1968 Olympic shootings in Mexico City. Or you have the economic collapse of 82. That also took a toll on the nation.
Or the 1994 Zapatista uprising. It was an agrarian uprising in response to the government impeding upon some of the Mayan people's land. And yeah, it was just one thing after another in terms of just the government sort of slowly but surely effectively ceding any credibility in the eyes of its populace. And what's interesting too is that historical trajectory was in concert in a lot of ways with the Mexican film industry, because the Mexican film industry, you had from about the mid 1930s up through the early to mid 1950s, that's considered the golden age of Mexican cinema. And then you had something of a brief resurgence in the 1970s, like, for example, with a film like Canoa, which, if you've never seen that film, I saw it for the first time earlier this year, and Jesus Christ, if there's a film that that is about this time, but, like, I mean, it's a film that's about, it's a true story that is about a particular horrible incident that happened in Mexico. But if you need a film that really perfectly summarizes the way that fascistic mob mentality causes people to do horrible things to innocent people, it is a frightening film. I mean, that's just my plug for, and it's directed by Felipe Casals, but yeah, it's a film that's actually gotten, finally within the last 5 years, like something of a critical reappraisal thanks to the Criterion Collection and filmmakers like Guillermo del Toro and Alfonso Cuarón really bringing it to the fore. And I think it's important that we mention those two filmmakers because, as some of you may know, they, along with Iñárritu, were considered the three amigos of what was sort of the 1990s generation of Mexican filmmakers. Am I correct in that assumption or in that statement?
Well, yeah. I mean, and it's been highly publicized throughout the years, but, you know, they happen to all be making these movies around more or less around the same time and really got their start. And then they kind of, and they made highly impressionable names for themselves with their first films. Like, you know, Del Toro and Cuarón were more like in the early 90s, while I believe in Inuyasha, actually, he was a radio DJ around that time.
He was. Well, yeah, he was a radio DJ, like, from the 80s. Actually, this is interesting. I read he said something where that he considered himself more inspired by music than cinema. And I can absolutely see that because I think, you know, there is a very rhythmic pulse that influences his films. Like, I mean, Birdman, if you look at the score of that film, it's all dictated by the rhythm of that drum beat. You know, and I would say like there's a similar thing going on with the use of the hip hop, late 90s, early 2000s Mexican hip hop and rap that's sort of constituting a lot of the soundtrack of Amoros Perros.
Yeah, I was going to say like, yeah, there's a lot of songs in the soundtrack which really they're like a strong indicator of the mood and the tone that he's going for in this movie. And I do think he does have a solid ear for music. But yeah, to talk about the Three Amigos, I mean, it was not just the fact that they all kind of more or less were getting their start around the same time, but some of them coincidentally started, like, working together. Like, Del Toro and Corón actually worked on this Mexican television show called La Hora Marcada, in which Del Toro was the director's assistant and Corón worked on special effects. And coincidentally, the cinematographer on that was Emmanuel Lubezki, who also goes by the nickname El Chivo. And as we know, he's Cuarón's go-to cinematographer, and he would also shoot Iñárritu's last two films.
Not to mention help, you know, Terrence Malick in the last 20 years with his cinematic output, like kind of define that visual style of his career.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But what I find interesting, too, is like, yeah, it's how they kind of, their lives were interconnected, and they would, like, work with each other, or they collaborate, or they give each other feedback. Like, actually, Guillermo del Toro, he actually helped Iñárritu out with post-production editing work on Amores Perros.
That's right.
He later would become an associate producer on Beautiful. But, so it's like, and they talk about how they have a very tight, close-knit bond with each other, where they would, you know, show each other scripts and they like give merciless feedback to each other, you know, trying to make the work stronger. And how, yeah, like I said, they just work on each other's films too. Like, yeah, Cuarón producing Pan's Labyrinth for Del Toro. And I just find them very interesting because the fact that they have this close friendship with each other, but I think that they manage to, you know, they go from making these strong debut features in their native Mexican, you know, homes, and then going into Hollywood, and then kind of like, and leaving such a strong impression. I don't know if I can say like radically changing the whole system, but they certainly have, you know, left an impression where I think they gave a sense of representation, inspiring, I think, I'm sure, for many Mexicans to see like these directors being able to have such a strong input on Hollywood with the works they made.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, within this last decade, definitely. I mean, when you look at the output of those three filmmakers, I mean, they've just really come in and presented some technically extraordinary work. I mean, even something like The Shape of Water, which, I mean, did very well, you know, and I wouldn't call it Del Toro's best film, but I mean, it's nevertheless, it struck a chord with people, and understandably so. I think it makes a lot of sense that it did well at the Oscars, and it did well with a lot of people because it's technically adventurous and playful and stylish and true to his own sensibilities as a storyteller who's drawing upon these tropes that he loves to explore and deconstruct in all of his work. And I mean, it is interesting that these three really stayed close because, I mean, I think it would be a mistake to think about kind of the Nuevo Cinema Mexicano movement from the 90s onwards. Yes, they were the three, arguably the biggest names to come out of this, certainly the most influential, but there were other filmmakers too, and other movies. Of course, I mean, early 90s we had like Water for Chocolate, which was an international hit, but then you had other filmmakers coming along who they didn't penetrate the mainstream as much as the Three Amigos, but they've still produced some interesting work, like Arturo Ripstein, Carlos Regadas, 2 years after Amoros Perros did his first film. I mean, he's a controversial figure in his own right, but nevertheless, he's occupied his own place as a as sort of this titan of art house cinema in Mexico. And what's great about that, I think, with all these filmmakers, is that it reinforces, not just in Mexican cinema, but within Latin American cinema, there's been a very noticeable transformative shift that's been, that I think we've been able to observe over these last 20 years. I mean, if I had to give another example of, I mean, for example, like, I mean, within the last few years, you know, we finally have started to see movies coming out of Guatemala and Colombia from a lot of adventurous young new filmmakers who are utilizing the medium to directly or indirectly address the trauma that their countries have undergone or experienced. Or if you look at a country like Argentina, you have a filmmaker like Lucrecia Martel, who is really one of the premier talents to come out of Latin American cinema in the last millennia, in the new millennium. You know, I mean, 1 year after Amoros Perros, she had La Cienega, which was released, and that really caused a sensation. Since then, she's utilized this withering, banal studies of the bourgeoisie and of the and the way that that's symptomatic of a colonialist legacy throughout her work. And it's certainly left an impression on some other filmmakers. I mean, just one film I saw last year from a first-time director, Los Tiburones, The Sharks from Uruguay. The influence of Martel was unmistakable on that film in terms of its own restrained, banal, pitch-black comic tenor. But what's great, too, about a place, a country like Argentina is that you have other filmmakers, too, like Mario Ginas, who, I mean, as you all know, directed my favorite film of last year and one of the best films of the last decade, La Flor. I mean, and there's, I mean, well, that's one of the most inventive films I've ever seen. So there's, and it's very much rooted in that literary history or literary tradition that began with really José Luis Borges in the early 20th century. So, I mean, that's all to say that, I mean, to bring it back to Mexico, that there's this interesting transnational movement going on in Latin American cinema. But with these filmmakers, particularly with Iñárritu, with Cuarón, with Del Toro, I think especially at the beginning of the millennium, I would say that there's this interesting moment where they're returning to Mexico, or at least like with Cuarón and Del Toro, they did a couple of movies in Hollywood, and they go back to Mexico, and they find themselves creatively rejuvenated. I mean, especially like Cuarón, you know, he just does Y Tu Mama Tambien in 2001. And that even, like, that explicitly is more directly about the Mexico that was just on the cusp of Vicente Fox's election, you know? So all these filmmakers in some way or another, I think, were responding to the changes that were happening in their country and in the Latin American world, and channeling that into this really formally and visually striking cinema that is, as you've said, inspiring filmmakers today and changing the industry in Hollywood, for sure.
I mean, and certainly inspire, you know, it certainly leaves impression. I think it, and, you know, one of the things I love that's come from, you know, some of these filmmakers, like Iñárritu, is it opens the door of possibilities of for representation and for getting these voices out. As you said, you get, you know, for these different perspectives and angles, like you're talking about, parts like colonialist history or maybe some other dark parts of human history that maybe we're not accustomed to or comfortable with discussing, but that are essential to exploring in order for us, you know, to make progress.
Earlier, you were talking about that there were some good things and some things that you weren't crazy about with Amoros Perros. What were some of the elements of the film that you felt, did you feel like they were big flaws or detracted from the film?
You know, I think maybe they're just like quibbles, and I don't want to sound like I'm a nitpicker, and I don't know if it's also it ties into like having seen some of his later works that I kind of like, you know, come in and I go, oh yeah, there's a little bit of, because of how, you know, we feel like in Iñárritu, I think he tends to go on the pretentious side, especially with his last couple of films, and I feel like you get a little of that even in Amores Perros. With moments like, there's a couple of sequences in which violent, you know, montages where are inter- of the, you know, they have violence that are intercut with carnal sex. And it's like, I get what he's going for, but it felt very on the nose. It's kind of like, you know, that kind of Rogian type of montage intercut editing that it's like, you know, when you have your imitators, it's a very tricky line where it's like, all that's missing is for there to be a caption that says, get it? So there was that component, and there was also like some plot elements or threads, which I think he was trying to like make it feel more jaded and to shocking, like, and sudden, spontaneous, you know, to shock the audience, because, and that ties into realism, where then these things all of a sudden just inexplicably happen, like, you know, all of a sudden a person just gets killed, you know, for instance. Like, there's a moment where a character gets killed over, like, at the end of the second act, I would say. And when it happens, it's, I mean, yeah, I can understand what he's going for, but for me it was kind of like a, and they were kind of setting up and building it up, but I was kind of like, well, that happened.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. When that does happen, that part, like, structurally, because the film is also, like, even though it's following these three discrete storylines, it does take some of the other characters, you know, from different storylines, and, like, you know, you see them kind of popping up, or you kind of follow them for a little bit, and then they disappear for a while. And, I mean, in some levels, I'm glad that Iñárritu and his screenwriter Arriaga were looking to try to be as economical in their storytelling choices and in terms of setting up certain things, so the whole thing didn't feel too prescriptivist in terms of, oh, we only can talk about these story elements with this character in this section, you know, because then that would have, I think, been a little too leaden and a little, it would have impacted the pacing of the film, you know. And it's already a long film, it's a 2.5 hour film, and I know that, you know, there's 16 minutes of deleted scenes, so I mean the thing was almost nearly 3 hours long, which I mean, frankly, I think is a little too long. But I do agree with you, like, there are moments where in his attempts to sort of resolve certain storylines, there are moments where it just feels a little, it does feel a little like he's forcing his hand a little bit in terms of
trying, like, you can see the calculating in it. You can see the structures, you know, the plots and structures in it, in the mechanisms of the script.
And to his credit, there's, I mean, I think in the second story, I think that the main couple, when they get to a point where their relationship starts to fray, I felt it frays very quickly, and I was a little surprised that things kind of escalate between a shouting match between them, you know, and it's almost like a shouting match that's sort of persistent. And I know Iñárritu described the film as sort of like 2 hours of nonstop shouting, which I think is a little unfair to his own film. I don't think it's quite that shrill, but I mean, I do think that there are sections of that where the theatricality of the film overshadows some of the cinematic qualities to the degree that it you know, it kind of feels forced. But to Iñárritu's credit, you know, with that second story, when the couple starts to argue, there were some more sequences that, because of structural problems, they weren't able to fit in, and that does impact the flow of the film. But personally, I don't think it doesn't derail the film, or it doesn't detract significantly from some of the strong qualities of the performances, or even of some of the story turns.
No, I don't think so either. I don't think they destroy the movie either. And, I do think that Amores Perros is a very strong debut. I think, and I feel like it was a very strong start to a promising career from a clearly very talented and skillful director.
I would agree with that. And I think it's 20 years later, it's definitely an interesting snapshot of a Mexico that sort of, maybe I'm reading a little too much into the film, but I think that there is something about the final shot of the film that harkens to this sense of a trepidatious walk into the unknown future, away from this strictly controlled social structure, into a future that, in a way, visually harkens to this agrarian past of a Mexico that's founded upon a sense of egalitarianism of the revolution. I mean, it's interesting that the El Chivo character, at one point he's described as a guerrilla figure. I mean, he was a guerrilla before he was arrested for 20 years. And then another character, when he hears that he's a guerrilla, he asks, like, oh, like a Zapatista? And, you know, it's kind of a throwaway line, but it's something, too, that, like, of course, the Zapatistas carry a lot of cultural baggage within Mexico. And as we were talking about earlier with the uprising in 1994, it was something that was still pretty relevant within the cultural consciousness of the Mexican people. So I think the film is playing a little bit with this sense of Mexico's history and a cautious, if not hopefulness, maybe optimism at least, for a future that might be better, but who really knows. I will say, at the very least, I do know that I think in 2017 the country finally outlawed dogfighting, so that's definitely good news.
Yeah, no, I think it's wonderful that they did that, and you know, that again, when you have a film that has that much of a powerful influence, that even if though it was a while after the film came out, but that inspired, you know, to outlaw this, I think it, you know, that's the power of art. It's like with Rosetta, how that you know, I think may inspired to the French government to make some changes.
Oh, you mean the Belgian government?
With the Belgian government. Yes, sorry. Thank you. Like the way it infected, like some people getting work in the trying to get a job. So, and that's the beauty and power of art.
Well, just fair labor practices, really. That was what Rosetta did. Yeah, I mean, on the whole, I would say that Amoros Perros, as someone who's not the biggest fan of Iñárritu's work, I gotta say I liked it, and I would. If you can stomach some of the more brutal and really bleak elements of the film, I think it's definitely worth checking out 20 years later.
Yeah, I would highly recommend checking out. Maybe it's my favorite of his movies I've seen so far, but I like to finish the rest of his filmography. But
well, you know, I heard a rumor through the grapevine that Criterion might be releasing a Blu-ray of it in the foreseeable future, so, you know, knock on wood.
Doesn't surprise me.
No.
It doesn't surprise me at all, but I highly recommend it, and I just want to single out, you talked about this uncertain but hopefully optimistic future that the film ends on, which, when I think of that final note, it's kind of like, I think of it, it's like a Umberto D, but of the 21st century.
That's a really nice comparison, actually. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. It's like a gritty, and it does actually tie back into the neorealist tradition that the film is clearly drawing upon.
Yeah, as were many Mexican films during the Cine Nuevo Mexicano era. It's funny because, yeah, last week, The Circle, we talked about how the Iranian New Wave was inspired by also Italian neorealism. I mean, it shows you just how influential it was as a movement. But I think how we've also been looking at these movies that, you know, at the start of the new millennium, and it's the 21st century, and a lot of these movies end on these cautiously hopeful notes of, like, as we move forward into this new era of, like, maybe there'll be a chance for some good to come. Like, that was the case, too, with Traffic and George Washington. And it's kind of interesting where some good, you could argue, came out of the movie, because, yeah, with the ban on dogfighting, but there's still a lot of there's a lot of issues of corruption and economic inequality, I believe, still in Mexico.
Well, I mean, not to mention, like we were talking about with Traffic, just in terms of the difficulties with the cartel there. And then, of course, their relationship with the United States. I mean, it's, yeah, some good has happened since the year 2000, but many, many, many difficulties still tragically persist.
But, you know, and yet, but I guess the least we can do is, and I think this is what the film is trying to advocate for, is like, for some of us, we just have to keep pushing onward, you know? Keep on trucking, as the slogan says.
I suppose so. I think this is a great moment to keep on trucking ourselves into the weekly component of our show, where we talk about reviews of, or rather, we talk about films that we've seen in the last week that aren't related to the things that we've been talking about in the main body of the episode. I mean, already, and again, we've cited a bunch of examples of Mexican cinema that, whether you've seen them or not, are worth, and of course, Argentine cinema that are worth checking out. But I wanted to ask you, Alex, is there anything that you've seen in the last week that really struck you or that, that is worth checking out?
Yes, I have seen some stuff. And I guess I'll make a brief recommendation, too. What I've seen was, and this is funny because we alluded to Tarkovsky at the start of the video, but I just saw his one of his last features, Nostalgia, the other day.
What did you think?
I really liked it, actually. I thought, with some of his movies I've seen also Ivan's Childhood and The Mirror. And Tarkovsky was one of those very unique, singular directors where he just had a way of pulling you in into this dreamlike state and trance with his films. And even though I think Nostalgia was more clear to me than, say, something like The Mirror, where you can tell what's present and real and what's past or subjective, but you always feel like you're going through a dream when watching the whole film. And I liked too how it was discussing elements of faith in it, and about finding purpose in life, and about hope and humanity too, you know, trying to fight for humanity and for the world.
And that film was also made during a period of exile for Tarkovsky, and so of course he was really experiencing a lot of despair, and I think that's apparent in the film.
Yeah, I think it is. But, and I think that's sort of why, you know, there's an infamous climax in the film that some of you cinephiles might know about. It's a 9-minute long take involving this a character holding this candle and trying to get from one spot to another in the pool, in a drained pool, without the light going out. And just hearing it on paper, you think, oh, that sounds silly. But it's actually, I think it's quite powerful when you watch it, and it's very compelling and gripping, you know, to see if he's able to accomplish this, you know. And it's, in a way, it's him kind of finding a renewed sense of faith and purpose.
Well, and here's the thing, too, what's so great about, I mean, I think I told you about this when I was trying to describe to you about Nostalgia, but when I was talking about that scene, and like you said, like when you read it on paper, it sounds silly or even boring. You know, that's a 9-minute take of just a dude walking, you know, back and forth between this pool, you know, and this candle keeps going out. And you ask yourself, as an audience member would ask, like, well, what's the significance of that? What does that mean for the plot? And, you know, I would say nothing. And yet it means absolutely everything. And Tarkovsky completely understands that. He makes you feel the weight and significance of this test of faith. And it's, and the way he visually conveys it in this tracking shot is just extraordinary. It is one of the best sustained long takes I've ever seen in a movie.
I agree with you 100%. And it's one of those movies that I don't think I'll be forgetting anytime soon. So if you never seen Nostalgia before, I mean, like, it's a little slow, but that's a par for the course with Tarkovsky. But I think if you're willing to sit through it, I think you find it to be a powerful, unforgettable experience.
Well, I mean, Tarkovsky is always difficult to recommend to people who've never seen any Tarkovsky. And I can't help but wonder if Nostalgia is, I mean, it's a great film, and I think it's definitely worth checking out. But I mean, I feel like, you know, there should be like a survivor's manual that's published for, well, if you're going to tackle Tarkovsky, start here and then, you know, ease your way into it, you know, because, like, yeah, there are certain of his films, like, it's difficult to know what's the shallow end of the pool and what's the deep end of the pool with him as a filmmaker. I mean, maybe Ivan's Childhood might be the most accessible in a lot of respects, but even that's, you know, it's still recognizably the work of the filmmaker who would do Stalker and Solaris and Nostalgia.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I think if you're willing to sit with it, you know, and just give it a shot, then I say check it out.
Awesome. I'm really glad you saw it, and I'm really glad you liked it. I mean, I know this is, like, you know, time for recommendation for, you know, us to talk about a movie for a while and not for the other person to keep interjecting. But I'm just so glad that you got around to it, because, yeah, I'm a fan of Tarkovsky. And every time from my perspective, watching one of his films, you really get a sense of somebody who's asking for your total commitment to the story that he's telling. And you need to bring that commitment. Otherwise, you are going to struggle. But if you bring your total attention to it, the rewards can be plentiful, I think.
I agree with you. What about you? What have you seen recently?
Well, you know, I got to be honest, nothing quite as demanding as Tarkovsky. I had a little free time the other day, and I went through MUBI's selection of films. And what's interesting is they have a series of films that they've been screening for the last month or so of Almodovar films, of films by Pedro Almodovar. And some of them are, I mean, many of them are pretty well known. All About My Mother, Talk to Her, Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, even Pain and Glory they have on the website. So, I mean, so yeah, you had all of these films. And but what was interesting is like the one film that they had that I wasn't quite as familiar with was a 1997 feature called Live Flesh or Carne Tremula. And this was a film that he made right. It's the film he made right before All About My Mother, which was really the film that catapulted him from the realm of cult adoration into more or less the mainstream praise from the film industry in the West. And what's interesting about a movie like Live Flesh is that it prefigures All About My Mother and Talk to Her in terms of its aesthetic quality, while still adopting many of the overtly melodramatic flourishes that were used to very pointed and even lurid effect in Almodovar's other classics like Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. And this film, so, I mean, to give you an example, just to talk about the plot of the film. So the plot of the film, more or less, is it follows a young man who, in a convoluted and bizarre series of circumstances, finds himself going to the house of a heroin addict who he slept with the week before, and he wanted to see her again, and she rejects him. He goes to her apartment because he has her number, and he finds her apartment, and he goes up to her apartment. There's a scuffle between them. The police are called, and one of the policemen who is, or one of the police officers who's played by a very young Javier Bardem, is shot. And then we cut to 2 years later. The young man who fired the gun is in prison. Javier Bardem is now a paraplegic athlete who is dating the woman who was the addict. And then we cut again to another 4 years after that. The young man, Victor, has just left prison. And he is beginning to impede upon the lives of not only Javier Bardem and his wife, but Javier Bardem's former partner and his wife. And so, of course, there is this quadrangle of sexual liaisons, of romantic entanglement, twists and turns. It's all a good bout of melodramatic fun that seems to be ripped from a sleazy headline or a pulp paperback. And actually, the film was based off an American pulp crime novel. And I think that can be felt when you're watching the movie. But I think what makes Live Flesh a fairly underrated entry in Almodovar's filmography is the degree of not just narrative, but visual sophistication that he brings towards presenting different elements of sexual autonomy, of virility, and of power. I mean, for both his male and female characters. And this, the way that he knowingly exploits or winks towards loaded phallic iconography, but then zigs where you'd expect he would zag to subvert any preconceived expectations of what this sort of a story should look like. And consequently, what that does is that he ends up having our alignment with his characters fluctuate. He doesn't present any of his characters in clear-cut shades of heroic or villainous. They all are, to one degree or another, very messed up people who also, in a more explicit sense, are the children of the Franco era. And the film does actually indeed open in the 70s when Victor is born. He's given birth to in a bus on a night when Franco declares martial law, and his mother is a very young Penelope Cruz, actually. And so Almodovar is very explicitly linking this miasma of messy navigation around sexual mores and socio-political stature within a post-Franco Spain. And he's doing it with a sense of, I would argue, compassion for all of his characters. There's not a sense that there's anybody here who's the butt of a joke or who is a gawkish, grotesque clown to be laughed at. All of these characters feel very recognizable and very flawed and human, even though they are, one might say, a little warped in terms of their own sexual proclivities or their own sense of romantic entanglements. But again, it's not, Almodovar doesn't consider these elements from a place of judgment, but a place of compassion. And that actually ends up making the film a rich experience, and one that's absolutely worth checking out, and definitely worth rediscovering as an obscure or semi-obscure entry in the great filmmaker's body of work.
Well, yeah, I would love to check it out, and the way you describe it, it's like, and even with the way he likes to, you know, divulge into the melodrama, and with these coincidences and twists and plot twists and turns, but also with phallic imagery, and like the way he also discusses sex, and I'm like, yeah, that sounds like typical Almodovar. But what also is very typical of him is, as you point out, I think his compassion for his characters that I think would become prevalent particularly during that time period, like, and then with this and All About My Mother, and from then on afterwards. So, yeah, and that's, I think, what makes him such a strong and solid Spanish director. So I would certainly love to check it out.
And, of course, just again, to reiterate, just visually the film is, of course, Almodovar's films are visually lush and rich, but I would argue that Live Flesh actually might be one of his most visually astonishing works. It oscillates between the palette of something akin to a Fassbinder film and, of course, a Douglas Sirk melodrama, but it strikes a very happy medium, and it feels like, in that aesthetic sense, an important turning point for the filmmaker. So definitely, if you're in the UK, or if you just are able in the US to find it somewhere on a streaming service, absolutely check out Live Flesh. Watch it with the whole family.
Yeah. You could watch a lot of Almodovar's films with the whole family.
Oh, sure. Why not?
Yeah, why not? Show the Matador.
Honestly, you know, I would say Volver would be a really great Mother's Day movie.
Oh, yeah.
But I will admit, it's not the most usual or orthodox Mother's Day movie. But, and of course, All About My Mother. All About My Mother is just, I mean, it's a masterpiece.
It is. I'm sorry, Nick, but, you know, I also, and this is why, you know, I didn't go into as much detail about nostalgia as you did with Live Flesh, because, you know, I also wanted to take a moment and take some of my time during this podcast to talk about something which has been troubling me. And I didn't plan on doing this, but I felt like I had to talk about this because, yeah, today's the 29th of August. And last night, I've been very troubled when I heard the news about the unexpected passing of an actor that many of you listeners might know of, Mr. Chadwick Boseman. And I guess, not, even though maybe there's not much to say that hasn't been discussed by people on social media or so, but I just was shocked to hear that what he had been going through, but and also the fact that he had that he had colon cancer for 4 years, and that he had been undergoing treatment all while working on all these movies. But I think that's I mention this because I think that's a component, I think, of what makes him such a formidable figure to so many people. And I think, when I think about him as an actor, I think about he seemed to have like this strong, hard drive to want to really play these larger-than-life figures, like whether they're real or fictitious, like, you know, Jackie Robinson, James Brown, Thurgood Marshall, and of course the role that, you know, the definitive role of his career, Black Panther. And yet, I've heard about how he too was very much, for somebody who was so charismatic and so large in life that you never would have suspected anything was wrong with him, he also was very humble. And I even saw this video where, when they're promoting Black Panther, he talked about a couple of kids who died from cancer and how they were looking forward to seeing the movie, and he got all choked up. And it was very emotional for me to watch that, and I think it showed just the compassion he had. And I think that even though his career was so short-lived, I think the impression he made and the way he inspired so many people, particularly black film viewers from not just America, but I feel all over the world with the figures he plays, it's like giving a representation, giving a voice, and being somebody that, a figure that people could look up to. And I think that's what people remember him by. And one of the films that I was thinking of as I was reacting to the news, I was thinking of one of his last films, actually, The Five Bloods, which came out just 2 months ago. And even in a film like that, I felt like he was perfect for that part, because again, that charisma and that power that he just exuded from his presence, and the way he can, and inspiration, I think it was it's there even in a film like this. And I think the scene I was thinking about was actually the scene in The Five Bloods. In case you haven't seen it yet, it's a good film, it's fine. But there are some great scenes, and he's actually in a couple of the best scenes of the movie. One of my favorite scenes in it was the scene where there's a flashback where he and his group, they just hear the news on the radio while in Vietnam. They hear the news about MLK's assassination, and they are rightfully very angry about it, and they want to, like, you know, they're like, you know, they want to kill the white man. It's like, fuck the white man. But he's like, no, you know, we're not going to do that. You know, I'm as angry as all of you are, but we're going to own this anger. I'm going to own this anger. And the way I think that it's just such a powerful scene, I think, of that initiative and ownership, you know, of like your identity that he exuded. And that's what I think about from him, and the way he inspires those figures. And I think of how extremely bittersweet and sad it is to think of how, because in the film you have these like middle-aged guys or guys in their 60s or so who still play themselves even from like in the 70s in Vietnam. But Bozeman is this guy who, you know, he's younger than them, but that's because he's immortalized forever young. And it's sad to think that now life imitates art.
I mean, I think you really hit the nail on the head in every respect, talking about Chadwick Boseman. I mean, it's never easy to talk about a talented artist or performer whose career is cut tragically short, and this is no exception. I mean, it is the, to put it very bluntly, the crap cherry on top of the shit cake that this week has been. But I think I really love you singling out the MLK sequence in The Five Bloods, because that is actually one of the first things that I thought of when I heard the news. Because, I mean, of course, T'Challa is iconic, and Black Panther is iconic. And I mean iconic in the sense that, I mean, I do think what will happen with Chadwick Boseman is that he'll be regarded in a way that someone like Bruce Lee was regarded as, like, this iconic figure for diverse representation of male autonomy that's rooted in a sense of confidence. But as you said, there's also this authority and this charisma and assuredness in Boseman's persona. And again, with that scene in the End of Five Bloods, I think what's so powerful about that, especially right now, I mean, of course, with all of this stuff that's happening in the world right now, I think the fact that that sequence, as you said, it's about them, it's not about them deciding to not be angry or to say, well, we have to put aside our anger to effect social change. What Lee is saying is no, no, no. And what Boseman is saying, really, what Chadwick Boseman is saying in the sequence is no, no, no. Own that anger. Be honest with that anger, but don't let the opposition weaponize it against you. And that's a very resonant message right now in the country and in the world. So it's deeply sad, but I think I think he really was a remarkable performer. And I do think that even though it's a small body of work, the body of work that he left behind really will stand the test of time as a tribute to his extraordinary talent.
And I really think that he's definitely going to, I think he'll be considered a legend in the film industry. I mean, I love how you compared him to Bruce Lee, because you're right. So with that kind of representation and what he represented and what he exuded, I think I totally agree with you. So my heart goes out to his family and friends, you know, as they go through this, you know, very difficult time. But, and, you know, I just, you know, and you're right, too, that it may not have been a large body of work, but by God, what a body of work it was, you know. So wherever you are, Chadwick, you know, rest in power, man.
Amen. And to all of you listening, thank you again for joining us on this journey through cinema. For any recommendations or thoughts or feelings that are related to cinema that you just want to share, feel free to follow and subscribe and comment. Tell us what you think about either anything ranging from the year 2000 to the work of Chadwick Boseman to the work of Andrei Tarkovsky. That's the beauty of cinema. It encompasses a wide range, and none of it is necessarily discrete or compartmentalized. It's all-encompassing in that way.
That's why I close our episodes with "We're all in this together," because it is all connected.
Absolutely. 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 So once again, thank you all so much. Keep well, be well, stay safe out there, and as always, continue watching great movies.
Take care, everyone. We're all in this together.
Oh, don't go and talk about my father. God is my friend. Jesus is my friend. He made this world for us to live in and gave us everything. And all he asks of us is we give each other love. Love your mother, she bore you. Love your father, he works for you. Love your sister, she's good to you. Love your brother, don't go talk about my father. God is my friend, Jesus is my friend. And when he calls on us for mercy, he'll be merciful, my friend. And all he asks of us is we give each other love.